So I hold myself in contempt if you try to pull me up here to court with that attorney.
The questions here, carjacker Willie.
Objection.
I'm going to allow it. It characterizes the defendant as a carjacker.
You didn't kill Thompson, but you did, Mr. Wells.
Yes, I killed Red Thompson. I killed him.
Order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order. They're out of order.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
And welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 297. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is P. Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am fantastic. Still very, very excited about our live show in New York.
Me too. Keep that weekend clear, folks. You're going to want to come. You're not going to want to miss it. I had the brilliant idea, and I'm going to plug it right now just for fun. We're going to make sure there's at least one nice, lengthy, fun, meaty segment during that live show that only happens there. And maybe for our patrons, but does not go out to the main show. Because if people are going to come to the live show, they should get something that nobody else is getting except our patrons. You know, patrons get everything because they're our patrons. We can't leave them out of the equation. That's just how patronage works. But we're going to have bonus stuff that only people there and patrons are going to hear. It's going to be so much fun. I can't wait. So, again, that's the August 9th, 10th. Leave that weekend open. We're still negotiating when it's going to be. You know, the venue is open, but we will get back to you real soon. 9th, 10th, 11th, that whole weekend. Make your travel plans. Okay. That said, Andrew, we've got a lot of show to get to, some of which was left over from last show, because one of us, not going to say who, one of us is a lawyer who has a lot to say all the time. I'll leave it to the audience to guess who that is. I'm 50-50. I really don't know who it is.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, certainly judging from our patrons, half of whom think that
I'm the favorite.
Their favorite lawyer.
That's right. Only one of our patrons. That's like one out of all our patrons. No, all right, we've
that's
got plenty.
Half. I'm not the math guy. Yeah. So.
We've got plenty to get to. We're going to talk about this Trump Twitter Second Circuit ruling. And the funny thing is, coincidentally, as we record, Twitter's actually down. Maybe by the time you guys are hearing this, there will be some explanation for all that. Who knows what it'll be? Russians? I don't know. Twitter's down. That's kind of a big deal. But when you're hearing this, maybe it won't be. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the emoluments case that I think took a step backward from what I saw. But maybe Andrew will give us a different spin. I don't know. We'll see. And then we're going to get to that. Janus heads. I know it is a big fan base on the Janus case that we were going to give an update. You're finally getting your update. We promise, subject to Andrew going too long and leaving it off again. But no, we should be good for the Janus case update in the C segment. All right, Andrew, there's your before you is your agenda. Can you stick to it?
I hereby promise all that right. I will stick to that agenda.
I love it. Let's do it.
No, I think I am very restrained, and I talk about important things.
I'm going to do very restrained if I use it at all. I'm going to do very restrained. I find it tremendous. It's a modern form of communication. There should be nothing you should be ashamed of. It's where it's at.
So tell us what's going on in this Twitter case. Any updates? Because I remember you making a bold prediction that you thought that constitutionally Trump couldn't block people on Twitter. Is that what this is about? Is that same case?
That is exactly what this is about. This is a recent decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, right? This is the Knight First Amendment Institute. We've talked about them before, versus Trump and Sarah Huckabee Sanders. It was a case that was brought on behalf of users on Twitter who were blocked by Donald Trump for disagreeing with the positions that Trump took. The Knight First Amendment Institute, that is a they are affiliated with Columbia University, and they argued that because Donald Trump makes policy pronouncements from his Twitter page. And in fact, like, I mean, that is an that is a grotesque understatement, right? Donald Trump is president via Twitter,
yeah,
right? He does not hold press conferences. He does not appear to, you know, take answers from the, he just, you know, shouts at his army of howler monkeys on Twitter. It is the gravamen of the developments in the census litigation.
Well, and right? when he speaks in person, he doesn't say anything. So he just goes on. What I tweeted the other day. I mean, when he, this kidney thing, he's at the whatever, like kidney research science, something. And everything he says is just as though someone told him in an earpiece, hey, you've got to vamp for like 10 minutes. Just find a way to stall because the main, because AC/DC is going to come on behind, but they're not ready yet. So you got to. And then he just goes, yeah, the kidney. Well, a lot of people love kidneys. We're all about kidneys. Kidneys have a very special place in my heart. And in the heart and kidney, and we're doing big thing. And he just, that isn't anything.
I don't like kidney beans though. Yeah. Those are too. Yeah.
Whereas his Twitter account actually can't be that because that would make no sense. Like when you're actually typing something, it's hard to just type, yeah, the kidneys. So he actually does more policy making from Twitter than he does in any form of speech, I think.
Yeah, that is 100% correct. He has fired people via Twitter, right? I mean, and again, you know, going back to the census question, right? The Secretary of Commerce announced that they were going to print the census without the citizenship question and then issued that via standard press release. And then the lawyers representing the Department of Commerce found out when the judge found out, hey, your client over Twitter said, nuh-uh, so what the hell's going on? So, yes. And that's really, really important to keep in mind here when we get into the significance of this ruling and the distinctions that we're going to talk about. The other thing that is orthogonal to this is I want to mention that a lot of organizations, both left and right, I happen to know, you know, a friend of the show, Jeff Blackwell, who is one of the in-house lawyers at American Atheists. This is an area, social media as a limited use public forum. This is an area where lots of civic groups are active, right? And so American Atheists has represented atheists who have attempted to interact. And again, this is typically more grassroots stuff, right? Attempted to interact with their elected representatives on Facebook, right? Because lots of, you know, particularly the smaller the office, the more, you know, you're looking as an elected official to connect with your community. And they've brought lawsuits where it's clear that the discrimination is viewpoint based, right? So sidebar, and this is very, very clear from the complaint, and this is very, very clear from the decision, but it's an important one. You can block people, even under this opinion, for neutral reasons, right? You can block trolls. You can say, I'm going to block people who use profanity, for example. And, you know, you might discover that, like, the practical consequence of blocking profanity is that, you know, atheists are more likely to use profanity than Christians. I'm not saying that they are. I'm just saying that might be the case, right? You can use neutral criteria that have a disparate impact. But the cases that I happen to know about through Jeff and through AA, for example, are cases in which, you know, typical Trump type cases, right? In which, you know, trollish behavior and bad language and obnoxious, you know, all the kind of behavior you would come to expect out of MAGA heads. All that's fine when we agree with you, but it's used pretextually when we disagree with you, right? So this is, all of that as a sidebar is to say, this is really an important fight, not just at the Second Circuit, not just with respect to Donald Trump, not just with respect to Trump and Twitter, but with respect to the question that we previewed and that for which I said, hey, they've got a good argument and, you know, do a little bit of a victory lap. That is, can public officials, by their actions, turn a private forum into a limited use public forum, right?
Yeah.
And that's what Trump has done. So let me read. And again, this is I'm going to link it in the show notes, obviously. This is a super easy decision to read. And I'm going to upload it. I would recommend that everyone read it. It's already getting, you know, misrepresented by the right wingosphere.
Well, of
and
course.
It's not hard. Yeah. It's not hard to parse through it. So, for example, and you don't need to read this the way we read complaints, right? Like, you can just read this straight through, right? It's like 15 pages long. I'm sorry, it's 20 some pages long, but you can just read it narratively going through. So early in the opinion, page 4, the Second Circuit. And again, this is the appellate circuit that sits over New York and northern New England. They say, we do not consider or decide whether an elected official violates the Constitution by excluding persons from a wholly private social media account. Nor do we consider or decide whether private social media companies are bound by the First Amendment when policing their platforms. Okay, so those are some of the red herrings you're already seeing getting tossed around. Yeah. Oh, well, you know, right.
So are people saying, so no one can block anyone from their account, that kind of thing.
It's worse. I was gonna get to this, but I'm just gonna jump to it. There's a lawsuit by a professional YouTube troll named like Joey Pants or something.
An invite to the White House, by the way, Joey Pants, any day. Also, Joey Pants will be testifying before Congress any minute about how conservatives are the real victims of something. That's the age we live in.
Yeah, no, yes, that is his shtick, right? So he's a professional YouTube troll. He's running for Congress in New York. He is not in AOC's district, but he has now filed a lawsuit against AOC, who has blocked him on Twitter because he's a troll. And he's like, well, look, if you can't block somebody, if you can't block the president, then AOC can't block me. And and again, like the level of either abject stupidity or willful ignorance that you have to have to read this opinion that way
is exactly the level we expect from Tom Pants. Yeah. No, it was Johnny Pants. What was it?
It's not even Joey Pants. I'm sorry. His name is Joey Salads. Okay.
Joey Salads. Better, right? Oh, that's much
Joey
more.
Joey Salads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when friends with salad. So anyway, don't you remember the great Simpsons, You Don't Win Friends with Salad song?
You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad. You don't win friends with salad.
You don't win friends with salad.
No, I don't.
Oh, that's from when the episode where Lisa becomes a vegetarian, right?
Huh.
And yeah, they start singing the, like, come on, Lisa, you don't win friends with salad. And then, like, Bart leads a conga line in which they're singing, you don't win friends with salad.
I am disappointed in myself because usually we're right. The one thing that we both are just eye to eye on is the Simpsons references. And we both usually cut off around the same season where we stopped watching.
Right. Yeah.
But that
right.
one, I know the episode. One. I know the episode. I just don't remember that song. So I'm sorry. I want personal apology from me to you, Andrew.
Go watch it.
I failed.
Anyway, yeah. So this doofus thinks that this case means that public officials can't block people on Twitter, despite the fact that the court says we don't say that. We also don't say that Twitter is bound by the First Amendment. We do.
Right.
Now I'm back to reading and not because you can tell because I'm not. There's no Joey Salads reference in this. We do conclude, however, that the First Amendment does not permit a public official who utilizes a social media account for all manner of official purposes to exclude persons from an otherwise open online dialogue because they expressed views with which the official disagrees.
And that makes perfect clownhorning sense to me. It really does. Yeah. I mean, oftentimes we talk about decisions that we don't agree with and make no sense. This makes sense. It's not by default a public forum that nobody can block anybody on. It's just if an official, government official, starts using it in a way that's like, you know, announcing policy, doing meaningful stuff on it that citizens have a right to be a part of, they can't be banned for a viewpoint they hold. Makes perfect sense to me. Am I wrong?
Yeah. That is 100% correct, right? And it is why, right, when you hold You can do whatever you want at your campaign rallies where you're not acting in a public capacity. But when you are acting in an official capacity, right, when if you are a sitting senator and you go home to do a town hall, right, you can't be like, no, I'm only going to do a town hall with Republicans and I'm going to turn it into a campaign event. You can't do that. You have, when that is a public forum, right? You know, could you imagine if, right, Democrats take over the legislature, they're like, okay, we're going to open this up for public comment and we're going to hear from, but, you know, you got to be a Democrat to come in. That's preposterous, right? That's the First Amendment protects against viewpoint discrimination in limited use public fora in government situations, right? So, and again, The Second Circuit is super clear on this. Here's what they say. Of course, when a court tells you, of course, like that, right? Of course, not every social media account operated by a public official is a government account. Right. Whether First Amendment concerns are triggered when a public official uses his account in ways that differ from those presented on this appeal will, in most instances, be a fact-specific inquiry. Sidebar, the importance of that, we've talked about that before. When an inquiry is fact specific, it means that it is a challenge to dismiss out at the motion to dismiss stage, right? It means that usually you will survive a motion to dismiss, but you know, it does not mean that the law is one way or the other. It means there could be a situation of facts. So, for example, and again, I just want to use this since we talked about Joey Pants here, Joey Salads, Joey whatever, right? It is possible, right? If he alleges I was blocked by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for disagreeing with her political beliefs, and AOC says, no, I blocked him because he's a YouTube troll and an idiot, then the court may well say, yeah, we need some discovery as to what the reason was why she blocked you. So, you know, it may survive that initial motion to dismiss. There's no chance of it surviving a motion for summary judgment. There's no chance of getting any kind of actual relief there. I just want to point out the standards. That's an OA staple, but, you know, it's worth pointing out again. Back to the Second Circuit here in the Knight case. The outcome of that fact-specific inquiry will be informed by how the official describes and uses the account, to whom features of the account are made available, and how others, including government officials and agencies, regard and treat the account. But those are concerns for other cases and other days and are ones we are not required to consider or resolve on this appeal. Again, makes total and perfect sense. Donald Trump uses his social media platform in a way that is directly analogous to the town halls of the past. And God help us, this may be the way in which politics is conducted in the future. And, you know, we've talked about how the law is sometimes slow to follow technology. This is the Second Circuit going, yeah, no, that this is a direct analog, right? If Twitter is going to be the town halls of the 21st century, then we are confirming that First Amendment principles apply when a government uses that in that capacity to conduct and transact official business. And again, we've focused on the, it must be viewpoint discrimination, right? You can still block trolls. You can, you know, I want to also focus on the second disclaimer that the court gives. That does not mean that Twitter in general is subject to the First Amendment. It is not. Mm-hmm. Twitter can still block, can still keep Milo or Jordan Peterson or whomever from spewing garbage that they don't like on viewpoint discrimination basis, right? The First Amendment does not apply to all of Twitter.
So yeah. If Twitter were doing the same thing that Trump was doing, like if Twitter was proactively going and blocking people or something, or like disabling accounts of people purely for viewpoint reasons, that would be okay because they're not a politician.
That would be okay because they're a private party.
Yeah, okay. They're not. That makes sense. They're not a politician. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, right. And again, think of the analogy there, right? Like, suppose your sitting senator holds a town hall at a local restaurant, right? That That does not, that means for purposes of that event, that local restaurant was converted into a limited use public forum. But once the limited use is over, it's no longer, you know, it's not a public forum anymore, right? It goes back to being the private property of the restaurant owners. So again, these are 100% straightforward, ordinary principles.
Well, but the, actually the analogy I was trying to draw was, what if during that one night only public forum event, the restaurant owner was still discriminating on the basis of viewpoint and was like, I don't want this guy in here. I don't want that guy in here. You know, like,
yeah. And that would turn that then, that's a really great question. That then becomes part of that fact specific inquiry in the passage that I just read, right? Because, you know, you would want to see, okay, is this, you know, at what point was the forum converted into a limited use public forum, and in what way, right? So, so let me go back and answer your question more precisely, right? If Twitter had announced, particularly let's assume before Donald Trump was president, hey, we're going to block users who do X thing, right? And then it went through and blocked them, even on blocking the president's account, right? Then that would not implicate the limited use public forum doctrine, because that's just how Twitter treats its forum, right? That is akin to, you know, no shirt, no shoes, no service on the sign on the outside, right?
Joey but, Salad's out there without a shirt. Hey, what? Oh, I'm being discriminated against.
Right, right. That's exactly, that is exactly right. And in fact, why don't we leave it there? Because shirtless Joey Salad's suing AOC for not letting him into her, her bar.
Or it's more like Joey exactly Salad's is at a different restaurant that doesn't have a public event happening and is like, hey, you got to let me in without my shirt. That's more like that, right?
Yeah, that is exactly right.
Good old Joey Salads, who we didn't know anything about and still know nothing about.
We didn't know. Yeah, still know.
Look,
I mean,
forward to him
himself
testifying before Congress within the next week about how conservatives are the real victims. It'll happen, I'm sure. Mark my words. Yeah, it'll happen.
I think he says he's going to get stomped in his race to run for Congress. He says like his YouTube channel has over a million views on it, which, you know, I mean, Opening Arguments has 8 million downloads. So, you know, like, it is, he is, as far as I can tell, 1/8 the size of us. So so we're probably actually sending people his way. But there we go.
Don't anyway, go listen to Johnny Joey Salads. All right. Well, I think we can't do any better than that. Also, it sounds like, Andrew, we ought to run for something. Apparently, we could. I mean,
yeah,
might
we
as
could,
well.
If, we could lose
Joey Salads.
Could
do
Joey
it.
Yeah. Salads. I mean, come on. Yeah.
Nah, right. We're having a great
look
time.
Look for that in this space.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to our main segment here, talking about the emoluments lawsuit. Now, I saw the headlines, but of course, like a good OA listener, I'm waiting for the Andrew breakdown, but it didn't look good, but it's at a circuit court or a federal court level. What happened here with this case?
Yeah, it isn't good. And it isn't good in exactly the way that we predicted. So let's make sure we bring everyone up to speed, certainly because we have a lot of new listeners. We covered this lawsuit back in episode 78, way back
how
in
young
2017.
We were. Oh, our
yeah,
hair.
It,
we
was, had, it was 2 years
we
ago.
We had long, flowing hair. In the
I
hairspray
had no beard.
And the curls.
It was, yeah. It was weird.
Oh, that was worse. It was, yeah, no, I'm glad. Yeah. Some things are better, some things are worse.
Yes. And if you go back and listen to episode 78, you will hear me be skeptical of this lawsuit. I should add, as an additional background, we did a 2-part interview. I still love this interview. I think Seth Barrett Tillman, originalist, Irish law professor, conservative, came on for 2 hours and discussed his very, very interesting argument, not one that persuaded us, but interesting argument that the Foreign Emoluments Clause does not apply to the President of the United States. So we're going to talk about that. The court still has not, no court has validated the Seth Barrett Tillman position. Okay. So not this opinion, not any court to consider it. So now let me set it up. But if you want to go back and listen to a really interesting argument from a smart guy, than Seth Barrett Tillman, episodes 35 and 36. And this will be linked in the show notes. So now, what was the lawsuit over? The lawsuit is over Trump's efforts to enrich himself and his businesses by being in office, by directing foreign dignitaries either implicitly or explicitly to stay at his hotels and use his golf courses and, you know, all sorts of nonsense like that. The state of Maryland, represented by my buddy Brian Frosch, attorney general of the state of Maryland, and the District of Columbia sued. And they said, look, we have an interest in free and unfettered competition in our states and in the District of Columbia. And the president is interfering with that competition by using the power of his office to prefer his businesses over other businesses in the district. And like, we care about that. Like, those other businesses are the source of jobs and taxes and right. And this is part of what we do in a state is we want to see fair and open competition. And so they brought this lawsuit seeking an injunctive relief to prevent the president from doing and saying stuff that would promote his business, his businesses. What made it interesting was these were brought under the Foreign Emoluments Clause and the Domestic Emoluments Clauses to the Constitution. Those clauses are the Foreign Emoluments Clause is the one that we discuss the most on the show. It's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8. And I want to add, just for purposes of analysis, the Foreign Emoluments Clause is found in Article 1. Article 1 is the article that governs Congress, right? So this is really interpreted as a power of Congress, which is going to be important in a minute. Whereas the Domestic Emoluments Clause is found in Article 2. That's the article that sets forth the powers of the president. And I think that's significant. So going back, the Foreign Emoluments Clause says you may not grant titles of nobility and no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall, without the consent of Congress, accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind whatsoever from any king, prince, or foreign state. And so the argument there, the Seth Barrett Tillman argument, is that the presidency is not an office of profit or trust under the United States. Again, that's been rejected by, or I shouldn't say rejected, that has not been accepted by any court in which.
Yeah, I mean, do we really need to keep analyzing it under that lens? Like, it seems like that's not the lens.
I think it's worth pointing out, Seth Barrett Tillman filed an amicus brief in this case, and so and in the other Emoluments Clause cases, and so far no court has embraced that position. I think it's worth pointing out because if the president is impeached, one of the grounds in the articles of impeachment is going to be the emoluments clauses, and this argument will rear its head again because certainly Seth Barrett Tillman is not a Trump. I mean, he's a conservative guy, but he took this position before Trump took office, so it is not a pretextual position advanced to advantage Trump. But lots of Trump sycophants are going to jump on it because that's what they do. So that's why I mentioned it. But you're right. It's not so far. It is just an argument people make anyway. So that's the Foreign Emoluments Clause. You're the president. You can't get a gift emolument of any kind from any foreign country without the approval of Congress. And when foreign dignitaries come and stay in your hotels and golf courses and stuff, that's pretty clearly a foreign emolument.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Case closed.
Close to me, right? Yeah. Domestic Emoluments Clause, Article 2, Section 1, Clause 7, says the president shall at stated times receive for his services a compensation, which will be neither diminished nor increased during the period in which he shall have been elected. Okay, so he gets paid, comma, and he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them. Okay. So in other words, you know, a state can't say, oh, great. You know, like Pennsylvania can't be like, oh, great. You elected our guy. We're going to give him some extra money. The president can only receive the constitutional salary during his term of office, which can neither be increased nor decreased. And again, it's not hard to see kind of the anti-corruption antecedents to that. where, you know, you would imagine, right, at the founding of the Constitution, at a time in which government positions were, you know, sort of largely part-time and the citizens were not, you know, all, you know, multimillionaires and billionaires, right? You could imagine the corruption that would ensue if Congress could say to the president, hey, we know you disagree with this policy, but, you know, if you don't veto it, then we'll double your salary, right? if you read the Federalist Papers, it's not said quite that starkly, but that's kind of what they were thinking, right? They were like, no, this is going to maintain independence, right? The president's salary can't be increased, can't be decreased, and he can't get money from anywhere else. Here's how the Fourth Circuit put it. And this is going, we're going to talk about the results in a minute, but the Fourth Circuit said, there can be no doubt that the intended purpose of the Foreign Emoluments Clause was to prevent official corruption and foreign influence. I think that's true. While the Domestic Emoluments Clause was meant to ensure presidential independence. Again, I think that's true. So that's the background with the two clauses. Maryland and the District of Columbia sued, and they said, look, all of these businesses and directing people there violate these two clauses. I said, I think that's going to be a challenge. But the district court in the District of Maryland ruled in favor of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington and the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia and said, yeah, in fact, that's correct. All of this stuff that Trump is doing does potentially violate the Emoluments Clause. And now we're going to allow you to proceed to discovery. What Donald, and you might say, okay, well, that was 2 years ago. I know court opinions, you know, and stuff in the justice system takes a long time, but why don't we have that discovery, right? And the answer is that Donald Trump took an interlocutory appeal to the Fourth Circuit and said, I need an order enjoining this discovery order because this case is nonsense, and we want to get out, and we were denied our motion to dismiss, and now we're going to have to produce discovery, and the district court screwed up in denying our motion to dismiss. The reason they had to take an interlocutory appeal is that denials of motions to dismiss are not ordinarily immediately appealable. So when this decision came out, it was like, oh, look, like they're actually going to have to go through to discovery. So this opinion is the Fourth Circuit ruling on that interlocutory appeal. We told you this was coming back in episode 239, which was at the end of 2018. And the court issued an order staying discovery in the case and requiring the parties to brief up the question of standing. That is this a justiciable controversy? And this ruling that just came out a couple of days ago is the Fourth Circuit saying, no, this is not a justiciable controversy. The states, the private parties, do not have standing to raise claims under the Emoluments Clause cases and dismissing the case. So there will be no discovery. At this point, Brian Frosch has said publicly that they intend to appeal to the Supreme Court for reasons. And again, not even on political grounds. I could see the Supreme Court rejecting that 7-2 or possibly even 9-0, right? Like it you don't have to be a pro-Trump hack to sign on to the Fourth Circuit's opinion. That being said,
so the idea is just Congress needs to do something about this. It's not
correct. And I'm going to talk about their reasoning. I do want to say, however, the Fourth Circuit, you know, this is coming out of Maryland. The Fourth Circuit is generally a pretty left-leaning circuit. It is not as liberal as some, and it is certainly very conservative historically on the rights of criminal defendants. We've talked about that. But if you were expecting this case to be adjudicated on partisan lines, boy, Trump hit the jackpot in terms of the panel that he drew here. The panel he drew was Judge Niemeyer, who was the most conservative pre-Trump justice. Judge Quattlebaum, who was a Trump appointee, and Judge Shedd, a senior justice who was a George W. Bush appointee. So this is the literally, I'm 100% serious. This is the most conservative panel you could draw in the Fourth Circuit. So a little bit of a warning sign in terms of if you were thinking that it's a close legal question, and so, you know, is the situation likely to drive any of the court's analysis? You know, there's a very, very conservative panel. So what did they hold? The court holds that because of the purposes of the Emoluments Clause that we just described, that is anti-corruption and presidential independence, that the theory that the Emoluments Clause protect them from unfair competition in the market for the government business must be rejected. And they give a couple of reasons for that. So what did the court hold? The court held that the plaintiffs did not have standing to allege violation of the Emoluments Clauses, right? Mm-hmm. That if the Emoluments Clauses are designed to ensure the independence of the presidency, right, that's the domestic clause, and that the lack of corruption between our government and foreign governments, the court reasoned that the Constitution didn't mean to put that in the hands of private plaintiffs alleging anti-competitive harm within the borders of their states. And to be honest, it's a pretty good argument, right? And so, one of the things that I find very persuasive is where the Fourth Circuit says, look, with congressional consent, the Constitution allows federal officials to accept foreign gifts and emoluments, regardless of its effect on competition, right? So with Congress's consent, the hospitality plaintiffs could still face increased competition in their market for businesses from foreign governments, but would have no cognizable claim for redress in court. And that's a pretty good.
So it's sort of like if just the president were screwing you over, okay, maybe there'd be problem. But if both the president and Congress wants to screw you over, then it's fine. Nothing can be done about it.
Well, and look, that's why it was critical for the Democrats to retake Congress in midterms, right? Yeah.
Well, okay. So if the president and one chamber of Congress wants to screw you over, nothing can be done.
Well, that's not true, right? Because it requires congressional approval, right? In order
to approve. Well, but if the argument is that because.
Yeah, you're right. That the remedy.
The remedy is impeachment.
Absolutely. Yeah. If the president manages to control one of the chambers of Congress, and this really is the failure of imagination, and you know, maybe understandable, but the failure of imagination that is so clear when you go back and read the Federalist Papers, and our elected officials are such craven cowards that they place their political alliances over the health, well-being, independence of the nation, then yes, there's nothing that can be done.
Yep.
And look, like that's where we are.
That's where we are.
Republicans openly understand that Russia interfered in our elections in 2016, and most of them, almost to a man, and they're almost all men, do not care. I think if you were to pose that hypothetical to Alexander Hamilton, right, to Thomas Jefferson, and be like, okay, but what if members of Congress are, you know, value their loyalty to the president over treason? And I'm using that in the colloquial sense, not in the actual criminal sense. Like Hamilton would be like, well, right. And what if they're riding a unicorn? Right. Well, you know, okay. Like we can't talk about everything and that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, the failure of our Constitution is the failure to plan for, you know, that.
Yep.
But that is, in fact, where we are. Yes. So the Fourth Circuit has now held that this is a non-justiciable question, that you do not have standing, that the kind of remedy, the kind of interest that these clauses were meant to protect are not the kind of harm, is not the kind of harm that the plaintiffs have suffered. So the legal phrase for that is that plaintiffs' injuries did not fall, quote, within the zone of interests that the emoluments clauses sought to protect, end of quote. And again, for reasons that go way back to episode 78, I think the Fourth Circuit is probably right on that. And I want to point out that since we've referenced originalism in here, I think it's always worth kind of emphasizing this. Whenever I say originalism is a bankrupt philosophy, I always get folks who write back and will give me, you know, Elena Kagan's bit, you know, of talking about how we're all textualists now, or the, you know, people will say like, oh, so you don't care, you know, every time we then talk about like what the founding fathers intended, they'll say, oh, well, so now you're going to be an originalist. That's not what that statement means, right? Like, people who hold by the ordinary model of jurisprudence, with which I hold, it's not that we think it doesn't matter what the framers intended. It is what counts as evidence of what the framers intended, right? The ordinary model of jurisprudence says the way in which we figure out what the framers intended is by looking at precedent, is by looking at how that has been interpreted by courts longitudinally over time, particularly when we're talking about a 230-year-old provision, right? Originalists, capital O, what makes it constitutionally bankrupt is they say, yeah, we don't care what happened in the middle. All we care about is time traveling back to 1789 in my mind, where I can then, on the basis of a totally sparse record with absolutely nothing to go by, use the dead mouths of the founders.
I can put on a three-cornered hat and improvise a monologue about what I think probably this guy would have thought, is what it means.
That's exactly right. So there we go. The point is, there have not been, in my understanding, any similar cases in which private plaintiffs or governmental entities have prevailed in a civil lawsuit under the emoluments clauses in history. So, you know, so we have no precedent to help analyze that, right? That's part of why, again, for somebody with an ordinary model of jurisprudence like me, I would say this is a tough question, right? It's a tough question because we have a very, very sparse historical record and we have no cases interpreting it. It's an easy question for an originalist since all they care about are interpreting the words. But that's why I'm not an originalist, and that's, you know, part of the difference between the two. So now we're kind of left going back and going, okay, you know, what do these clauses mean, and how do we apply that meaning with respect to the question of, did they intend to give people, was the zone of interests that were encompassed by these clauses, does that extend to plaintiffs like Maryland, the District of Columbia, and public interest groups? And the Fourth Circuit said, on balance, we don't think so. And again, I think they're probably right. I thought the district court did as good a job as possible articulating the other side of the argument. And obviously, I would be happy with the result. But as a matter of legal interpretation, even though conservative panel, Trump appointee on there, I can't say that they're wrong as a matter of law. I can say I think the private efforts to enforce the emoluments clause are they're probably dead at this point.
Yeah,
so we're going to see. Yeah.
So the odds that, you know, the Supreme Court is somehow going to overturn this, not likely.
I don't think so, because look, to overturn it, you have to say, look, it is not, you have to go with, the record is super sparse. This was intended to be an anti-corruption principle. The Fourth Circuit agrees with that. And because of the unique circumstances that we're in today, the best way to enforce that anti-corruption principle is to allow private parties to bring this lawsuit, to allow the states, you know, the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia. That's a reasonable position, right? But that position will go nowhere at the Supreme Court, right? Because you have five voices that won't even listen to that argument, right? Like if I were arguing this before the Supreme Court and trying to, you know, trying to assemble a coalition from the liberal majority and pick off Justice Roberts, you know, I think it would be incumbent upon me to try and find some example from the mists of time in which, you know, there was private civil enforcement of these kind, and as far as I know, there aren't any, right? So, you know,
it's, yeah, I hear
will,
you.
This would be a tough argument.
You've convinced me. I don't feel like this is going. It probably won't even grant cert. I would imagine, most likely, right?
It could certainly be the case that they would not grant cert. Right? Yeah. Look, the court's liberal minority could, because it only takes four votes for cert. But if those four are chatting to themselves, and Kagan is like, I'm kind of lukewarm on this, right? And Roberts is like, you can feel free to grant that. You're just giving us more work because you know how this is going to come out. And by the way, like, I don't know if Supreme Court justices do that. Every other judge in a cert court that I know of has those kinds of conversations, right?
Meanwhile, though, I mean, I know the House has been doing some stuff, but has the House made a targeted effort to investigate, get things going on specifically these emolument questions?
So the House's current, and the answer to that is no at this point in time, right? Let me bracket that a little bit. Emoluments generally is that question is on the House's radar. Okay. But there's so much stuff going on that I think it has kind of slipped below the radar a little bit. The latest round of subpoenas includes David Pecker and AMI. So, you know, it suggests
so
that the House
killing
is
stories yeah, related. Yeah.
Yeah. Is going to go way back to, you know, what we said was, grounds for bringing down this president in terms of Stormy Daniels. And so, you know, so good on them for not dropping the ball on the president paid to silence a news story weeks before the election. I continue to think that that is significant for all the reasons we said in the Stormy Daniels is a Legal Genius episode.
Is it reasonable for me, a Democrat voter here, to say, why isn't the House getting more done? Why isn't there's not a dearth of opportunity here to get, why every week should be a different testimony on a different question of Trump's corruption, right? Well, am I being unreasonable?
Yeah, no, here's the way in which you're being unreasonable, and that is that the investigative arm of the House of Representatives is confined to the House Committee on the Judiciary and the House Committee on Oversight, right? And those, so most of the rest of the House of Representatives, like, this isn't their job, right? Their job.
Oh, so you're saying the House is too busy passing all those laws.
If the predicate of your question was, is the legislature broken, right? The legislature is broken, okay? And we've talked about that on the show dating back 20 years to Bill Clinton, right? So the legislature is broken, no argument there. But in terms of compared to normal, right? Like, why is it that the House is not just, issuing new subpoenas every week and kind of going full throttle forward? And the answer to that is because these Democratic representatives still have to do their jobs. They still have to win re-election. And if, you know, you serve on the Transportation Committee, you know, suppose you're a junior Democratic congressman from Montana, right? You're in a purplish district and, you know, you serve on the Transportation Committee. Like, you're going to have to go back and tell your constituents why they should reelect you. And it's super easy for somebody running against you to be like, look, this guy, it's not even, he's a Democrat, right? Fine. But like, you know, he's still got to do stuff and he hasn't done anything, right? Mm. So, and even the folks who serve on, you know, Adam Schiff and the folks who serve on those committees also serve on other committees. So with that being said, in the grand scheme of things, I think this Congress is moving ahead very, very quickly, right? Like, we've just seen the House is going to pursue criminal contempt against Bill Barr and Wilbur Ross in connection with the citizenship question, right? We've seen they have filed a case in the District Court for the District of Columbia seeking to enforce the subpoenas for Hope Hicks and Don McGahn that we've talked about on the show. So, you know, it's that they are. I share your frustration. I wish it were more directed. I certainly wish it were moving more quickly. I certainly think it is fair for us to try and keep the pressure on Democratic members of the House of Representatives and Republicans too, right? Like, you know, and everybody. But if you want an explanation, you know, as to why it's not proceeding faster, like, I think that's the explanation.
Yeah. All right. Well, those Janus heads in the audience, in the full Kiss makeup, except for Janus somehow, they want you to make sure we get to our C segment. Does that wrap it up for emoluments?
It does indeed.
All right. So get on and it, House.
And it wraps it up in a, yeah, in a sad
that's
way.
Over. Yep. I mean, it's okay. Yeah. Too bad. You make a good case, though. I understand it now. I get it. The law sometimes is what the law is, and that's reasonable. But that just means the Congress needs to pick up the slack there and do its job. Okay, let's get to, finally, our long-awaited update on the Janus decision. What's going on there? Down. The law. Down. The law. Down.
The law.
Down.
The law. Yeah, so this isn't actually an update on the decision. This is talking about the real world aftermath. So we've talked about Janus versus Ask Me, and I use that as Exhibit A when I discuss the Supreme Court's right-wing activism.
Mm-hmm.
It is the beginning of the end of stare decisis, in which this Supreme Court 5-4 said, yeah, we didn't like this decision from 1971, so we're just going to change it, and too bad. I emphasize that part a lot because that's near and dear to my heart, and watching Clarence Thomas in print say, you know, stare decisis doesn't apply to decisions I don't like, that's terrifying. But I want to point out, Janus versus Ask Me has right-wing implications on the merits as well, right? The whole point of the underlying decision, right? The reason that right-wing activists wanted it is because conservatives have been trying to pass so-called right-to-work laws in various states for decades. They were unable to pass those laws in Michigan and in many other states. And so they went to court essentially seeking an activist Supreme Court to impose by force on the population a right-to-work law for public sector employees. And again, put that in sarcastic scare quotes, right-to-work means the right when you are in a, and in this case only a public sector union, when you're in a public sector union that represents and bargains for you collectively, for you to withhold your dues. That's what Janus won. And the update is, he is now, has raised an administrative claim, soon to be a lawsuit, against Ask Me to give him all of his back dues back. So not only did he want the right going forward not to have to pay dues to the union that represents him and negotiates his salary, that negotiated is important because, of course, Mark Janus has left Ask Me and is now a senior fellow at the Liberty Justice Institute and a professional conservative talking head running around the country talking about how bad unions are. But while he was a union member, Ask Me negotiated on his behalf. They used his union dues for union purposes, not for direct campaign purposes. But now, in addition to winning that victory that people no longer have to pay union dues if they don't want to, which creates an enormous free rider problem, he's trying to set the precedent that you can go get your back dues from the unions. Watch this going through the courts, because already, I'm going to include an article in the show notes, already unions, look, like, unions have to put on a brave front, right? They can't say, in the wake of Janus, we're getting crushed. But in the wake of Janus, they're getting crushed. Large public sector unions have lost revenue, even as they've increased their memberships and they've tried publicly to sort of stem the tide, because the broader pool hasn't made up for the fact that now, You know, it, the word just spreads within the union, like, hey, you don't want to pay this, you don't have to pay it. And the average worker is like, well, look, you're telling me they're still going to work for me and I don't have to pay it, right? I mean, it's, you know, it's like Patreon, right? Like 90%+ of our audience doesn't pay us. 10% does. If there was a law requiring 100% of our audience to pay us, then, you know, we could do this show every day.
That'd be great. Yeah.
That'd be fantastic. Let's get that passed. So look, like it incentivizes free ridership. The unions are getting crushed, and there's going to be a two-front war going forward because look, unions are one of the last institutional sources to which Democrats can turn, you know, that is kind of roughly comparable to roughly on the same playing field as big business interests. And so conservatives have been trying to weaken the influence of those unions politically. Drying up their money is one thing. The next, and we have warned you that the next battle is going to be extending Janus from public sector unions to all unions. That will be coming down the pike. But add to that the additional danger of under Janus being able to claw back to go back and get your past dues. And boy, if that happens, that'll be a disaster, right? That will it will instantly incentivize an entire class of plaintiff's lawyers who will say, hey, have you been in a union for 20 years? Would you like tens of thousands or even millions of dollars? We, you know, call, you know, sue them and how, and we will get you, right? And it will be a feeding frenzy. They will incentivize the market to sue unions into oblivion.
Well, look forward to that happening for sure. 100%.
Yeah. Look forward to that. That I predict that will happen. So if you're an unemployed lawyer right now, like start burnishing your credentials in terms of, being able to eventually sue, under the various collective bargaining statutes, right? Like start doing those cases now, because this is going to be the asbestos of the 2020s. It's going to be lawsuits trying to claw back past dues from unions, which will sue unions into bankruptcy. I like to think that I'm wrong on this. You know, maybe the courts will rein that in, but you know, we'll see. So,
all right. Well, on that cheerful note,
Janus update was worth it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for delaying the execution, stay of execution last week. But there we go. Bad news. Bad news city. Oh, that's bad. But here's good news. Patreon.com/law has amazing benefits. And we are going to thank our new patrons, as we always do each and every week. There's got to be a lot awful movies. I'm going to predict here. I'm going to look at my crystal ball. There's got to be a lot awful movies coming your way either already or within the next day or two, because that's when we owe it to you. You're going to want to hear it. It's so much fun. There's so many reasons to join patreon.com/law. And that's one of them. Here's another one. The shout out. I want to thank Ollie Isaac, Olivia Peachley. That's a fantastic name, by the way. Olivia Peachley should be in like a Jane Austen novel or something. I don't know. Zanzibar Bungalow, Todd Jenkins, Hugh Chardon, and Helga, a bunch of unpronounceable characters, but something. Helga something. Your turn, Andrew.
Thank you, Helga something. Yeah, thanks to Nathan Suritsky, to Ben Troyer, to Mr. Harry Butt's favorite fruit is dingleberries. And yes, if you donate to us on patreon.com/law, you can get a Harvard-trained lawyer to say Mr. Harry Butt's favorite fruit is dingleberries on the law.
I hope you're happy with yourself, patron.
There you go. Good. Tyler Pascal and Yeet the Rich.
All right. Okay, now it's time for the thrilling conclusion of TTTBE.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Well, How did I do?
Yeah, Thomas. So this was a straightforward criminal law question that you once again analyzed exactly correctly. So again, remind our listeners, customer asked to see an expensive watch. The criminal comes in and goes, hey, you know, I'm the son of the mayor. I like this watch. I'd really like to see how it feels on my wrist and look at it in the sun. Dons the watch, goes outside, makes a break for it, later happens to be mingling at a function where the store clerk comes up and sees him and is like, hey, dude, you stole my watch. You got to give it back. And the criminal says, hist. You'll be sorry if you mess with me.
Did the thing from the first Lord of the Fellowship of the Ring where Bilbo is like does that.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. Right. And intimidated, the clerk backed off. And then there was a list of crimes in descending order of significance. And the question was, what is the most serious crime that the customer committed? Those were A, robbery, B, larceny, C, false pretenses, D, embezzlement. You eliminated C and D, which were good eliminations.
Yeah. Tell me that. Did C make any sense? Is that a crime? I don't get it.
So false pretenses, there is a crime of procuring the personal property of another by false pretenses.
Well, okay, sure, but that wasn't in there. It just said false pretenses. That's not a crime.
Yeah, well, but that's what it means when it says false pretenses.
How am I to know? If I'm a lawyer, I'm picking apart these words. It says the following is a list of crimes. Yep. False pretense. Whatever. All right. Yeah. I'm glad it didn't matter.
Because it's called something slightly different by jurisdiction. But yes. So the crime of false pretenses is I go into the bank and I say, I am the president
of
Microsoft.
So it's just yeah.
Yeah. Please hand me my money.
I am Guy Incognito. exactly. So just to, right. It's implied that there's something before the false pretense. There's obtaining something, you know, under false pretense.
Right.
Okay.
Right. False pretenses may be a lesser included offense here.
So that was a perfectly rational answer. It could have easily been that.
It could have been false pretenses, but it was more than false pretenses. Okay. And it was not a good elimination on embezzlement because there was also the trespassory taking, right? The actual physical sticking the watch on your wrist, right? So it's more than that. So then the question is it just larceny or is it larceny and robbery? And you said, every time I explain robbery, you forget. And you're like, no, wait. You had, this was like the chess move. Like you were like, well, so it's clearly going to be B. And then you're like, nope, my finger's still on the piece.
Yep.
I'm going to change my move to A. For like the fourth question in a row, you shifted away from the right answer.
Are you serious?
At the last minute. I'm 100% serious.
Wow.
So here's the thing. The test for robbery is not whether the victim was intimidated, but whether the perpetrator used force or threat of force.
Yeah, which the perpetrator did. So I got it right. Okay.
No.
All right.
The way this hypothetical is written.
No, you said enough. No. Case closed.
The way this hypothetical is written, and it's very carefully written this way, and this is good practice for, I know we have a lot of listeners are taking the bar, so this is a good practice tip for them. This question is written in such a way that you cannot infer force, right? Instead, what you were supposed to infer is he's the son of the mayor, and it's going to go badly for you in the sense that, like, yeah, you've made a powerful enemy today.
He's
my
not the son of the mayor, and
he's
very
not.
Clearly, he said he hissed, "You'll be sorry if you mess with me." Intimidated, the clerk backed away. That is absolutely the threat of force, 1,000,000%. I'm not being funny. This is 100. You're just wrong. Like, okay, so the book is wrong on this question, is what you're saying.
I certainly, and again, I don't read it that. Like, I think the whole point with the son of the mayor bit, which it says that the clerk believes that, right? I mean, that's why the clerk lets him go step outside. He says, oh, yeah, all right, I can trust someone like you, the son of the mayor, with my merchandise, right? And then when he finds him, right, the the criminal's con is still on. He's like, you've made a powerful enemy today, my friend, right? Like, I certainly didn't interpret you'll be sorry as you'll be sorry because I'm going to beat the crap out of you. I agree with you on...
Well, that's absolutely absurd. I don't do this often or ever. Maybe a handful of times. This is stupid. Like, I got this question right and it's wrong. No, I'm not even joking. This is the dumbest thing in the world. If someone says, if hisses at you, you'll be sorry if you mess with me, and the person is intimidated and backs down, that's a threat of violence. Absolutely. 1,000,000%. Right, so this is just stupid.
I want to do this. I absolutely want to do this for after this episode airs on Tuesday morning. I'm going to put up a poll open to all patrons on whether you should get credit for the question.
No, what's terrible about this is that this isn't a question of law. I got all the law 1,000% right. I won't exaggerate. I got the law right. It's the fact that we're doing some weird Trump defense where it's like, well, when I said seize that man and beat him up, you know, I didn't really mean, obviously, you know, like what? Obviously, this is a threat of violence. Intimidated, the clerk backed off.
It's funny. I don't read it as a threat of violence. I'm 100% serious that I want to open it up to patrons. Get in and vote. Are you Team Thomas that is definitely the threat of force, or are you Team Bar Exam, and it is not the threat of force? I'm curious.
This is baffling.
I love it.
This is absolutely baffling. You know me. I messed it up. No big deal. This is just wrong. I absolutely redo. This is stupid. And I got it right. So like, it's worse than just a redo. Like, this is a question I got right. The bar exam is wrong. Sorry, everybody. Sorry that Andrew had to embarrass us with a wrong question. I apologize on behalf of the show.
And I will say we will go. We will go by the binding result of the votes.
So if enough other people are wrong, then it also will be wrong.
it's a question of the reasonability of the interpretation. I'm saying I don't interpret, and the bar exam didn't.
You'll
be sorry if you mess with me.
Here's what I would want to do. I'd want to get a neutral people who know nothing about any of this and just give them the phrase, he hissed, you'll be sorry if you mess with me, and then intimidated, the clerk backed off. Was there any threat of violence there is what I would want to ask to a totally neutral audience. I would be just absolutely dumbfounded if they, if the point is supposed to be that even though the guy is obviously not the mayor's son and stole a watch, and you're saying the clerk is so dumb they still don't understand that, but so therefore it's just a career intimidation. Why all the hissing? Just be like, you wouldn't want to.
All right. You've made your case. I will say this, right? Like it in evaluating this question, replace the son of the mayor with Eric Trump, right? Like, and if Eric Trump were to hiss at you, you'll be sorry if you mess with me. I wouldn't interpret that as Eric Trump is going to flail his little stupid baby arms at me and beat me up. I would interpret that as Eric Trump is going to run to daddy and then daddy's going to make my life miserable. That's all I'm saying.
Under your, you know, bizarre interpretation of the law that I can't believe is real. It's if you intimidate someone, it's just larceny. If there's any threat of violence, it's robbery. That's the difference you're saying.
Yeah, because it the question is the objectivity of the action, not the subjectivity of the victim's behavior, right? So the fact that the clerk was intimidated is not dispositive to the question.
Well, but how do we know, like, what is then? That sounds
you
like you're saying it
an
doesn't.
An objective, reasonable person standard of would an ordinary person under ordinary circumstances find this to be a threat of violence?
Yes.
So that's why. That's why we're
all
putting
right,
it to,
everybody. Case closed. Another citizens. Victory in the Thomas column. That should put me up to that closer to that 60%. Good job, everybody. Who else got this one right? Andrew, hop in your time machine.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
All right, Thomas, in honor of your answer, we have two winners for this week's TTTBE. The actual winner, getting it actually right, is AJ Hernandez. That is at AJ Hernandez JD. I think this is a second win for AJ, who writes, B, larceny. Series Pod was right that defendant larcened the clown horn out of the watch, but hissing like a snake is not a sufficient threat of force for robbery. So that's my position. That's AJ's position. You are half the winner this week. On the other side of the coin is Samuel Kidney of the Heart Brady, that is at Creeptastic Sam on Twitter, who says, my guess is A, robbery, because my entirety of my understanding of larceny and robbery comes from listening to Thomas puzzle it out. And the coercive element of the crime that Thomas pointed out is good enough for Thomas and is good enough for me. So there you go. We will let the fate of these two and their never-ending fame and fortune, which is not guaranteed, hinge on the outcome of the patron poll as to whether Thomas should get credit, whether hissing as the mayor's son really does count as coercion. You know where I am on this. There are your two winners. Let's make them both winners. Everybody follow at Creeptastic Sam, and also follow and also follow at AJ Hernandez JD on Twitter. Congratulations to both of you for being this week's winners.
Right when I think, you know, like it can't get any worse on this bar exam. I mean, now it's just inventing stuff out of thin air to get wrong. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Sorry that Andrew decided to pull a prank on you with this whole wrong bar question. But, you know, we'll do better next time. We'll see you for a Rapid Response Friday. And we'll see you on Lot Awful Movies and live show in a month. Weekend of August 10th. Leave it open. Come see us. I can't wait. We're so excited. We'll have other law questions that I'm sure make me angry. Maybe we'll even have questions that'll make Andrew angry. We'll see. Maybe the
Ooh,
tables will turn.
Nice teaser. Yeah, nice teaser.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.